Okay, so today we want to talk about Yirat Shamayim. It's a good topic, Erev Shavuos. It is a phrase that sometimes rolls off of people's tongues. Reishis Chachma Yiras Hashem. What does it mean to be Yirat Shamayim? It's an important question, independent of what Rav Amital innovated, and there's a lot of innovation in Rav Amital's description. You can read it in Ve'aretz Natan Levnei Adam. I think it's the first chapter of the Arsat Adam, what is it called in English? And he gave the earth to man. You don't know Rav Amital Sefer?
Yeah.
That's what we just consider.
Right, but it happens to be translated to English for anyone that wants to access that. Anyway, so first Rav Amital wanted to prove that Yirat Shamayim is not something that's natural or native or inborn. And you can just assume that if you are from and you fulfill mitzvahs or you study Torah or you're a yeshiva bachur, then it will come. Keep in mind, and I'll try to give you some of the framework for what Rav Amital is describing. This is a bit of a, not a residue, but a continuation of much of what the Musar movement tried to stake out. The Musar movement is a movement that develops around the beginning of the 19th century, and it takes a very bold claim, which has become so commonplace that we barely recognize how revolutionary it was. You can't just study Torah. You also have to devote time to moral improvement and reading texts about moral improvement. You and I would think that's obvious, but it wasn't, nor should it be. People assume that just by studying Torah texts, it was such a pious and devotional experience that demanded such tenacity and such focus and such religious predisposition that all these moral improvements would come naturally. You're learning HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. How could you not be an anav? How could you get angry? How could you be jealous? How could you not perform mitzvahs? How could you not keep... It was obvious that all these moral improvements would naturally emanate from concerted and focused Torah study. And then the modern world struck, and this dissonance between intellectual activity and belief systems and moral behavior started to emerge. And that dissonance afflicted Jewish communities as well. And now it's the turn of the 19th century, and you're finding people that are studying Torah, and evidently, it isn't leading to the type of moral improvement that it classically did. No one was becoming mass murderers, no one was becoming rapists. You're not talking about cardinal crimes, but still, the moral improvement that was so basic and innate within Torah study, people felt failed to emerge. So the father of the Musar movement was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he's seen as a revolutionary, and in many ways an outcast. People don't accept it because this is a very bold and audacious claim. You see, part of... If you ask me one of the fundamental culture gaps between the world you live in, I'd say double, the world you live in as people and the world you live in as women, I'll talk about that in a moment, and the world that I grew up in, is in the world that I grew up in, the Haredi world, you're haunted, I mean haunted, by the specter of Bittul Torah. And if you abuse 5 seconds of your life, that's a criminal offense, that's unconscionable, that's absolutely immoral, that's simply unacceptable. Bittul Torah, the Gemara says your first answer when you get to Shemayim, you're going to have to account for every minute. And the Vilna Gaon, I mean, there are stories and stories with shivering on his deathbed. You're the Vilna Gaon. Why are you shivering? He remembers 20 years ago, he wasted 20 seconds or 20 minutes, whatever it was. And that was hammered into me based on my upbringing. I remember going to ask my principal if I could see a movie. And he said, you can't, but not because of the content and not because of the association. He says, Bittul Torah. He said, but I'll make up the time. When I come home, I'll learn in place of those 2 hours. He said, make sure you learn that now also. And there's no room for any non-Torah-focused activity, unless, of course, it's absolutely justified by bare needs and substance and serving other people and mitzvahs. Now, I feel that that was a card that was a little bit abused. And again, when I say doubly, in our world, unfortunately, that type of time accountability and time responsibility in general, but certainly in the internet world, that's part of the challenge of internet. It's not just content, and especially, I imagine, for women, the content is not as crucial of a challenge as it is for males in some of the other areas of internet danger. But a lot of the challenge is still the same, of time abuse and time immersion and time commitment. I remember Rav Lichtenstein bemoaning the fact in his day that somehow he felt that women's education, women were not expected to be as the same time managers that boys were. He felt that boys, even in his world, were given a moderated but still important lesson about not wasting time and time accountability, and every minute has to be focused. And he felt this was in the 80s. I didn't know then. I wasn't an educator of women. And I don't really know the internals now, but I certainly remember him saying that. On the other hand, I still feel blessed. I feel like there's an eternal clock in my heart. I call it the Peter Pan clock, the clock of the crocodile. And I feel it if I waste time. I feel there's something, not just that there's a malaise or more. I feel like as if I failed something. I felt like I'm sparkle. I wasted a time. I've wasted time that I could be learning. Again, I don't lead that ethos, only that lifestyle, but there's a little part of me that's haunted by it. I think it's a natural deterrent, time wasting and time mismanagement. So Musar flies in the face of that whole perspective. How can you dedicate time that should be spent learning Torah? You think it's trivial. What do you mean? It's another part of our day. There's Musar, there's Halacha, there's Machshava, there's Gemara. People were learning 20 hours a day. That's what real Torah texts. And now all of a sudden you want to divert 2 of those hours to focus on moral improvement, and maybe even you'll read a text or two to help you enhance. Most of the time will be spent on self-inflection, introspection, moral discovery through the text, not the next halacha in the Gemara, the next Tosis on the page, the next Ramban. So we see this as a real cardinal offense, and there are real conversations about it. These are real debates. These are the great ideological debates in the yeshiva world. Obviously, the larger debate was reform, the conservative, that whole movement, and secularism. But and to a degree, there's some overlap between the two. Many of the Musarniks indeed were suspected of being closet secularists. And you're really not interested in Musa, you're really interested in secularization. So that was a fascinating result. Solanta was accused of a maskil, to the degree he may have been. Not a maskil with an agenda, but someone who had certain opinions that may have dovetailed with opinions on maskilim. But put it this way, this all came to a head in the latter part of the 19th century. There were fist fights in certain yeshivas in Europe between the Musar proponents and the old guard. The Musar proponents tended to be younger whippersnappers, younger Talmidim that had heard through social media, had heard about this whole Musar approach and were trying to introduce it into the vaunted yeshiva system. And the old guard didn't want to, and there's a lot of tension that flared. Yes, yes.
Wasn't it also related, I just remember learning this in history class, to like the fact that Hasidut was spreading so far and they wanted to add a little bit, I mean, like the proponents wanted to add more emotionalism learning also?
A lot of generalization that same. The word emotionalism means something very, very different for Hasidus. I wouldn't call Musar emotionalism. Musar is an attempt. Musar's premises, and we all know what's right or wrong in the tranquility of thought, but in the chaos of activity, we lose that lucidity. So if I tell you, is it right to do this or to commit that error? Of course not. But then when you're facing that moment, heat of the moment, you lose your cool, you lose your conviction. There's something psychological that overcomes your better reason. And Musar is an attempt to, look at me, just I'll help demonstrate, to inject the ideas into your subsystem, into your subconscious. The two battlefields, and the cognitive one, is the subconscious psychological one. In that respect, it's a foreshadowing of Freud in psychology, but it's not very emotional. Now, it wasn't purely cerebral because how do you take those ideas and insert them into your subsystem? You don't just read them, you chant them. You don't just chant them, you make physical motions and gesticulations called hispilus. You bang your head on the table, you scream, you... The old joke about the... See, the Musarniks would chant. They'd take a pasuk in Musar and they would chant it 1,000, 10,000 times a day. Because even though you know what the pasuk means, how do you... anything I'm looking for? How do you assimilate it? Deeper than knowledge, deeper than cognitive knowledge. So they would sit there and shout, Shivisi Hashem Lenekdi Samid! Shivi, screaming. What happened was the guys in the regular shiva were trying to learn. It's very annoying to try to crack your head over a Tosos when the Shmigagi next to you is screaming his head off. So they built these annexes on the side of the yeshiva, which were called the Musar Klois. Klois in Yiddish means a house. And they essentially exiled all the Musar next to the Musar Klois. You go there and you do your chanting. So the joke goes that a person is passing by the Musar Klois and he wants to see how this new Musar is practiced. So he walks in and he sees the star of the yeshiva standing on the bima, screaming at the top of his lungs in Yiddish, Ich bin agarnished. Garnished means I'm a nothing. I am agarnished. Ich bin agarnished. And every time he chants, Ich bin agarnished, he swings and flails his head violently against the bima. That's called the spilus, where if I want to insert it into my system, I have to bang my head so that somehow the ideas will flow through me rather than get stuck in my head. Not in my head, my hands clapping, screaming, shouting, moving. There's a lot of it's not emotionalism. It's props and gesticulations and energy. It's not emotional at all. In fact, it's very anti-emotional in certain respects. Anyway, so this rookie is looking at this star who's screaming, Ich bin Agarnish, surrounded by hundreds of Talmidim watching him rapt at attention. He says, this is interesting, let me try it. So this young rookie goes over to the side of the room, picks a table, and he starts screaming, Ich bin Agarnish. Ich bin Agarnish. The problem is, this rookie's pretty good. So slowly all the spectators, all the fans, migrate over from the original one to this new rookie, and they start surrounding him. 12 o'clock at night comes, time to shut down the musa klois. The star picks up his head, finishes his 10,000th Ich bin Agarnish, and looks around, no one's watching. Where is everyone? He sees over there, the corner, that new rookie. He's doing his 400th Ich bin Agarnish, and everyone's surrounding him. He says, Achutzba. He's here one day, and he already thinks he's more of a Agarnish than I am. What a chutzpah. As the joke told, at the cost and the expense of the musa, to deride the futility and hypocrisy of those who are opposed to musa. Anyway, musa has now infiltrated itself as mainstream. Every yeshiva, every framework has one way, shape, or form in their classic musa texts. But I want you to take it as a foregone. These are some of the texts that are quoted in musa to prove that Yirat Shamayim will not happen naturally. Rav Amital's closing. Remember, Rav Amital learned, he never told me this connection, but he learned in the Chevron Yeshiva in Givat Mordechai. Anyone know where the Chevron Yeshiva was before it was in Givat Mordechai? The Chevron Yeshiva was in Chevron and had to relocate to Givat Mordechai during the riots in the late 20s. Where was it before Chevron? What yeshiva was it before Chevron? It was the Slabatka Yeshiva in Europe, the second great European yeshiva. The mashkiach of the Slabatka Yeshiva was someone named Rabbi Nasan Tzvi Finkel, affectionately known as the Alter, the older man of Slabatka. And he would take boys under his wings and try to nurse them or nurture them into being gedolim. That was his, he was a gadol producer, he was a manager. I'll make the next Rav Aaron Cutler, and he did. I'll make the next Rav Huttner, and he did. I'll make the next Rav Ruderman, and he did, and countless others. This was a gadol creating. My Zaidi lived in his house. My Zaidi had pictures with, he had it, you know, over life, with the altar of Slobodka's kids on his lap, you know, in Europe at the picnic field or something. The altar of Slobodka was significantly influenced by someone named Reb Simcha Zisel Breide, who had a yeshiva in the place called Kel, which everyone makes fun of. Those are not true. The people of Kel were not silly. Those are just some silly stories, some German kids' tales lifted and superimposed onto the people of Kel. Kelm had some great yeshivas. Rabbi Simcha Zisel Brody was one of Rabbi Saul Salanter's three primary talmidim. So Slabodka was probably, one could say, the first major mainstream Musar yeshiva. A very different form of Musar. Talk about that some other time. It wasn't the classic Musar, but it's clearly a Musar-influenced yeshiva. These are some texts that the Musar Svarim will quote. For example, in Rav Amital, so Rav Amital learned in Givat Mordechai, let's say in the 50s, you're talking about 50 years after the Slabatka Yeshiva has its heyday around the turn of the century. So you still have a yeshiva in Givat Mordechai that's deeply, deeply influenced by these ideas that had gesticulated or had developed, the embryos had developed back in Europe in the Slabatka Yeshiva. So number one, Pasuk in Mishlei, Intevakshenu kakesef v'chemat monim techapsena, you'll search for it like silver, and you'll pursue it like jewels. What will you achieve? This is the second parak in Mishlei. Az tavin yiras Hashem v'das elokim tinsa. I mean, Yirat Shamayim is so obvious. Just learn. Just be yeshiva bachar. Go to Volozhin. Be from. Do a mitzvah. You'll be a Yirat Shamayim. Like, don't look for it like gold and silver. Search for it like diamonds. You have to understand it. Az tavin yiras Hashem. Or another gemara. These are all classic, great gemaras for Erev Shavuot. I'm Reb Chanina. Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyirah shamayim. Okay, is that a very famous statement? Shenemar, to support this position, so the Gemara quotes the pasuk in Re'eh, in which Hashem tells Moshe, and Moshe tells Am Yisrael, Ve'ata Yisrael. Now, what does Hashem really ask for you? Mashem lukech Hashem mimach, kiyim li'ira. So the truth is, that pasuk goes on and on. It's a very ironic pasuk. What does Hashem want? Oh, you're a Shemayim, mitzvos, vekros, on and on and on. Very cute pasuk. But the Gemara halts. I'll tell you something. Hashem lokech hashokim liyiro. So the Gemara says, the famous line, a member of Lichtenstein, screaming, shouting this line, Hota yira milsa zadrasi. Is yira such a minor, easily achieved attitude that Moshe can just trivialize it? It's just a cup of water. That's all I'm asking for. What is Hashem? You're a Shemayim? Of course not. The Gemara says, you're right. It's not fair of Moshe. V'amar b'chanina, b'chanina says the same, Reb Shimon bar Yochai, Hashem covets your Shemayim. Line number 3 from the bottom, actually you have a smaller print, in the Gemara says, Legabe Moshe, Milsa Zadrasi. Second line from the bottom, you're right. For you and me, your Shemayim is not easily achieved. It's difficult. It's challenging. It takes work. It takes focus. It takes study, development. From Moshe's standpoint, Milsa Zadrasi. One of the things we always marveled at Reb Lichtenstein is he just assumed that you were like him, which was, I don't say fatal flaw, but I think he assumed that every boy coming to yeshiva after high school probably finished Tanakh, probably finished Shisha Sidra Mishnah, probably had learned a few hundred block Gemara, and now you're ready to start. And people of that caliber sometimes have a hard time realizing that not everyone's cut from that cloth, and people are still making their way through the muck and developing and finding and discovering. And so Moshe says, hey, what is Hashem? What you're Hashem? Yeah, Moshe, for you, which is your Hashem, it's pretty simple. You know, we're average Joes, so we're average Jane Doe. It's not so simple for us. So a little bit offset of Moshe's self-perception and how he has to lodge responsibilities and challenges to the people, to the common folk. But, I'll tell you, but at least the Gemara itself acknowledges that for you and me, your Hashem is not something that's so simple and so easily achieved. That has to be struggled over. Or, as Iov, Perech Chafes, these are some of the psukim, Vayomer L'Adam, Hein Yiras Hashem, Hi Chachma. So that's a pasuk. Echoes with the pasuk in Tehillim, Reishis, Chachma Yiras Hashem. What's such a Chachma? Astrophysics is a Chachma. Mesechas Kiddushin is a Chachma. Understanding Yecheskel, that's a Chachma. Yiras Shemayim is from, you're a from person. Hein Yiras Hashem, Hi Chachma. Now, of course, this is going to appear in the introduction of the Bible of Musa Svar. But a caveat. The Bible of Musa Svar was appropriated as the Bible of Musa Svar. Because the Bible of Musa Svar is in Masil Sisharim. On the one hand, he was aware that he was creating a revolutionary work, which is why he has such a long-winded and emphatic introduction. If I'm writing a Sefer on, I don't know, Chidush Torah from the Gush from the Sechas Shavuot, I need a long introduction, people will buy the Sefer. If I'm about to write a Sefer or a book which is non-conventional, innovative, revolutionary, I have to justify why am I writing this book. So in all walks of life, anyone, I did a lot of reading of romantic literature, romantic poetry. So when William Wordsworth wrote Poetry of the Simple and the Common, I'd write a preface called The Preface of Lyrical Ballads to convince people that this was subject matter and people worth writing poetry about, because poetry is only reserved for classic. You can tell us, college girl, right? What did you study? Studying literature?
Not
studying. Not yet. Okay, so Alexander Pope and John Donne and the great classics of poetry always revolves around great high matter rather than common issues. So you have to write a preface. So the Masil Sesharim has to write Lavdil a preface to convince us that it must save is important. Now, keep in mind, who wrote the Masil Sesharim? Ramchal. What's the abbreviation of Ramchal? It'd be Moshe Chaim Luzzatto in Italian. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. He was also a fairly active Mekubal. And being a Mekubal in the early 18th century would get you hung. Not necessarily hung, but at least accused of being. Come on, if you're a Mekubal in the early 18th century, you'd more likely than not be accused of being a Sabbatist, right? Shabtai Tzvi, 1666. Tremors is still felt. Who is the most famous Mekubal of the early 18th century accused very famously of being a Mekubal? Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. Who accused Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz of being a Mekubal? Yaakov Emden. These are the famous wars of the early 18th century. Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz was accused of being a Sabbatist. So, when Moshe Chaim Luzzatto wrote his Sefer,
the revolutionary part of the Musar boy, it was the fact that he was a Mekubal. Put it this way, his name was Moshe, and his wife's name was Tzipora.
Yeah.
He writes about that. Let's have this, oh, by the way, I could have fallen in love with a woman named, you know, Sprinza, but I chose Tzipora. This was fortuitous. This was history-making. So basically, no one read the Sefer. I don't know if the Sefer is put in the Chayim, but people weren't accepting it to say the Sefer is Hilchos Yesharim. The Vilna Gaon comes around the second part of the 18th century and ratifies the Moshe Chaim Letzalta and ratifies the Sefer. But the Musar movement is still 100 years away. The Musar movement emerges in the early part of the 19th century. So he's pleading with his contemporaries in the early part of the 18th century to study this text, but he's not aware of a movement that's going to actually develop a movement in many people. He's one in the early 18th century, so he's not aware of the early 19th century. It's going to adopt his book as the Bible. So it's a very interesting historiographical phenomena where a book written earlier is adopted as a Bible for a movement. Normally, a book creates a movement. Here, a book is adopted as the Bible of the movement. So, in his Hakdama, he quotes the Pasuk in Mishlei. Im tevakshenu kekesev v'chemat monim techapsenu, az tavin yiras Hashem. Eino omer az tavin philosophia, oh, you'll study and you'll understand philosophy. Az tavin tchuna, metaphysics. Az tavin refuah, medicine. Az tavin dinim, sociopolitical law. Az tavin halachos, az tavin yiras Hashem. Harei lecha shelahavin hayira, tzarech levakesh osa kekesef v'lechapes osa chemat monim. And therefore, Hanimsa Zman, the second line from the bottom, his famous haunting chant, Hanimsa Zman l'shar kol chelki ha'ion. We're going to spend time on all the other points of inquiry. This Gemara, that halacha, v'le'ion hazeh lo yezman, and for this moral inquiry, we shouldn't dedicate time. Lama lo yikava adam li'atzmo itim lefachos. A little bit of time. You see how far it is. Today, people will take this as a given. A little bit of time. So here's Rav Amital's introduction about the need to take Yiras Shamayim and the pursuit of Yiras Shamayim seriously. Now the question is, how do you define Yiras Shamayim? What is Yiras Shamayim? Well, there's a lot of people outside. Okay, so we'll skip the Afilei Tohar, very similar about the importance of pursuing Yiras Shamayim. But the classic approach to Yiras Shamayim, and interestingly enough, this is the approach that a lot of Baalei Musar harp upon, is the approach called Yiras HaOnesh, what we would call fire and brimstone. We don't necessarily, and that's why Rav Amital was so innovative, I don't think you were raised that way, but certain parts of my education were raised that way. How many, did anyone here have a teacher who tried to inculcate Yiras Shamayim or performance of mitzvos with fear factors? Maybe you did. Did you have teachers who told you that if your hemlines weren't long enough, you'd burn in boiling excrement in Olam Haba and Gehenna? No, you didn't hear that one.
No.
Or that, well, that's what I heard. Or you'd receive fire and sulfur. That's not the education you had. But I would say that a Haredi Sefer is still a very powerful deterrent. The fear of punishment. Whether it's punishment in this world or punishment in the next world. Rav Amital obviously was not a proponent of that. And he's looking for some other definition of Yiras Shamayim. But interestingly enough, he found that many Rishonim also didn't seem to gravitate towards that idea as the pole of Yiras Shamayim. So, for example, even when the Rambam discusses Schar V'Onesh, he says as follows: Elu she'en lam chelek l'olam haba. This is the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva. These are the people who receive kares. Nechrasim bi'avdim v'nidonim agol gavrusham v'chatasam li'olam li'ol mi'olam. He's not graphic about their punishment, about what they're going to receive. They just get kares. Kares means you're cut off from benefit. You're cut off from that future eternity. You're cut off from opportunity. That's the greatest punishment, obviously. This isn't minimizing the punishment, but it's still abstract. You're cut off from something that you can't. The power of Yiras HaOnesh is meant to be graphic and concrete and compelling and fear-inspiring. The Rambam doesn't talk about how much you'll suffer and what your fate will be in this world or in the next world. You'll just be cut off from all those opportunities. There's only a list of five people that were, or the list of people. And even in Hilchos Tshuva, where he becomes a little bit more specific. He doesn't just discuss in general about people who are cut off. Let's see in Hilchos Teshuvah, Parakhas, Halacha Hein Gimel, then we'll go back to Parakhas Halacha Aleph. Halacha Hein Gimel, we actually describe what Kares is. Hanakama She'ein Nakama Gedol Mimena. This is the greatest suffering a human being can imagine. So this is the height, this is the ultimate. She'tichras HaNefesh, that the soul should be cut off. V'lo tiske lo senachayim, and you don't receive the benefits of Olam Haba. She'nemar Hikares Tikares HaNefesh Yavon Haba. V'za Avadon She'karon HaSanavim Derech Masho Be'er Shachas Avadon Tiftar Luka. So again, it's a terrible punishment, but it isn't described in terminology that you'll see in a moment that the Musarniks used and employed. And Rav Amital felt that even the Rambam didn't feel that Yerushalayim could be pivoted, even in his day, let alone in our day, that Yerushalayim could be pivoted on Yerush Amish. In Hilchas Tshuva, Halacha Aleph Perachas Hatova Hatzvuna LeTzadikim Uchay Olam Haba Uchayim Sheim Avisim Mayim. The Rambam describes the opportunity Hatova Sheini Mara Hushakasa Batar LeMayita Vlach Verach Diyamim Mayita VeOlam Haba Kol Mi Sheino Zoch LeChayim. Line number 5. So the Rama repeatedly talks about Kares, but you don't have the thunderbolts and lightning, you don't have the sulfur, you don't have the fire, you don't have the boiling excrement, you don't have those graphic descriptions of suffering that could, in theory, serve as a deterrent in a very powerful and vivid fashion. In theory, the Rambam omits them. Even though the Rambam omits them, of course, in Musar, it's very powerful. I want you to see a little bit of the Musar language. So look at the Mesilas Yesharim, again going back to the Bible of Musar, the bottom of the first side. Yesh Yesh Yiras Haonesh Mizah Min Achad V'Yesh Yiras Haramus, which we'll get to in a minute. Yiras Haonesh Kipshuta. Second line: Shadam Yarei Me'Avaras Pi Hashem Elokav Im Neha'onshim Asheli Averas. Because of the punishments, Im Laguf, whether your body will suffer, your physical experience, Im LaNefesh, your soul. V'hinei zel skala, this is meant to be simple and easy, automatic. Ki kol adam oiv es atzmo, self-preservation, fear, yirei lenafsho, ein davar sheyarchik osa me'asos davar echad yosim min hayira. And fear is a great deterrent. Shelo tevair bo ezera. V'ein yirei zeruya ela la'am ha'aretz. Of course, that's the starting point. We should try to proceed beyond that. That sense that it's a starting point wasn't always adopted by the later Musa Svarim. So let's take a look at... This is a sefer called Or Yisrael. These were letters Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, not digitized, wrote letters to all of his Musar sleeper cells. A lot of Talmidim that came to study Musar, and he'd write them letters to teach them the ideas of Musar. Ata mahi hayira, or mahi kiniyasa, how do you achieve yira? Achasi, harchavas hadavarim hanodim lakal, it's obvious to everyone. Yira sa'onesh hanogea legivia, the fear that applies to your body, that you'll suffer penalties and punishments. Okay, achein lo bidi asam yusar adam. Here's the Musar statement. Even though people know them, that still doesn't deter them. Kedam razal b'Shabbos, as the Chazal say in Shabbos, yodim rishayim shadarkam lemisa. Rishayim know that they're going to suffer, and still they don't retreat. How do you increase or internalize this? Virak, three lines from the bottom. Here's a classic Musar statement. Beharchava behispailus hanefesh tivaseid. Hispilus, banging, movement, energy, getting the soul into it. Hispilus hanefesh tivaseid will be established. Laharchiv harayon b'tziyurei chushi. Laharchiv harayon, to expand the idea with a graphic description. Laharchiv harayon b'tziyurei chushi. Leorer hanefesh b'riksha seivarim. Riksha seivarim. Making my body, my limbs feel it. Here it tests the emotionalism, but it's not my heart. It's Riksha Saivarim. The movement, the energy, the motion. That's why you see a lot of Muslim people moving and screaming and shouting and banging. That's how classic Muslim speeches. And a lot of banging and shouting and loud and just to get the movement and the energy flow. One of the Yisrael Salanter's Talmidim, an interesting one of his Talmidim, was the Yitzchak Blazer. It was a rabbi in St. Petersburg for Leningrad, but in the days of St. Petersburg, he quotes his Rebbe Yiras HaOnesh, the next non-digitized form, next page. Admar, he's quoting Yisrael Salanter, Bidrachav Musarav, he's saying, Lo halach bigdolos v'niflos. He didn't talk about sophisticated ideas, Ramos on high ideas. So Darcha Yiras Ramos. Kiyamachas Sadik Darko. Hey, took something very simple. Line number 5. Yiras Haonesh. Kihi Reishes Das. Fetzad Avishan Lavadasa Yisbarach. Leo Sarmi Rav Lasos Tov. Kimosh Kasav Admor Zal Bigeres Hamusar. The letter of Musa that he sent everyone. Visadasa Bahari Kodesh. And even our Chazal, the great mountains, already described this. Istakil B'Shlosh Devarim. Neinata Bede Dever Adami Ayin Basa. Show of hands, how many, just because I'm interested to know, how many girls have been to a funeral? Okay, because it's not so common that in Eretz Yisrael, sadly, a lot of people are introduced to death at an early age. Sometimes I've had kids your age, boys and girls your age, who's never been to a funeral. So part of the difference is the funerals in Israel are much more, much less sanitized. Funerals in Chutz Laaretz, you're sitting in a parlor, it's quiet, it's a movie theater type of effect, you've got comfortable seats, the mace is on stage in a box, and the rabbi's officiating, people come up to speak, and then they carry the coffin out, and you're watching. And everything. So it's much, much more bodily, deathly, the body. How many people have been to a funeral in Israel, right? So remember the body in the talus, you can actually see the body. What? Right, right. So it's very strident, it's very abrasive when you're not used to it. But after a while, believe it or not, after a while, to a degree, that's what a funeral is supposed to be. It's a mortality check. And the sanitization of funerals, again, creates greater distance between you and the confrontation of death. And funerals are meant to facilitate the confrontation. And maybe not at this age, you're still younger. And certainly, one of the things I want to plant in your minds for one day, not now, but one day you'll wake up, you'll be, I don't know, 30 years old in Mitzvah Hashem. You'll be living somewhere, hopefully advanced in all areas of your life. And one of the first questions that people have to think about when you move to a community, which to me is a must, is what aspect of the community are you going to be involved in? I don't like the condition where you take from a community, you just go to Minyan, you show up for Mikvah, and you show up for Mechiras Chametz. And you have to give something, you have to contribute something to your community. So there are many ways to contribute to your community, but one of the chesed's you may want to choose. Not when you're young. You shouldn't think about this for at least 15, 16 years, but when you get to a stage you're a little more mature, it's called Tara and Chevra Kadisha. And you come into contact with bodies, and obviously females for females and males for males. And your job, it doesn't always have to be, and some are more graphic, some are less. I'm officially in the Chevra Kadisha of Alon Shvot, but I really haven't had that much contact with the actual Tara process. You have other things you can do, but certainly that whole end-of-life encounter is an incredibly important equalizer, and helps you maintain your sanity that everything out of this world with all the flash and pizzazz and glitter is all passing. And again, you don't want to chas v'shalom lead a morbid life, and if you don't have the constitution for it, you shouldn't do it. Some people just don't have the ability. But if you do, then it's a tremendous chesed, and trust me, it'll be a very, very important, as I said, equalizer to help you avoid some of the entrapments of a very loud and enticing world. So, this is the classic form of Yirat Shamayim, and as you can probably predict, Rav Amital was very opposed to building religious instruction and defining Yirat Shamayim based on Yiras Haonesh. Why he was opposed was twofold, basically. I mean, he described it as three or four ideas, but you could pretty much divide them into two. Number one, he felt that most people don't have the type of sensitivity in their life that they had see cause and effect. And if you tell, and on paper it sounds correct. On paper, the fear is going to act. But most of us get lost, and most of us have cognitive dissonance where we know, but as the Gemara that Yisrael Salanter quoted, that Rosh Hashanah, we all know what's going to happen. We just put it out of our mind, right? Just think about other areas in our lives, not just Averos. When's the last time you, I don't know, acted irresponsibly? You knew that if you stayed up too late, you'd be tired the next day, but you're just too excited to be, not anyone in this room, you're too excited to be with your friends, or you overate, or you had a bad stomach ache, and all of a sudden everyone's having ice cream, and you needed the extra, whatever it is, nothing terrible, no great out there. So then you paid the price the next day, and you know what happened? Next round, you did the same thing. Right back there we began, this type of habitual recidivist behavior that is part of human frailty. So just to put all those chips and all that reliance on the fear of consequence and the fear of culpability, Rav Amital felt, first of all, second of all, that's not really the way the world operates. It'd be one thing if every time a person did an avera, all of a sudden that person would suffer that day. You find, ever read the picture of Dorian Gray? You know, every sin, all of a sudden the image starts to decompose and become more monstrous and grotesque. And we don't live in a world of Dorian Gray. We don't live in a world in which it's a cause and effect, at least in the moral plane, and it's out of people's mind and sight. And to introduce it, he thought and worried that for many people it would be artificial. But more important, Rav Amital felt three things. Not just that practically, here's a very, very subtle but important point, even if practically, he felt, number one, it would cheapen Avodas Hashem in an age of idealism. There's no question that man lives more idealistically, or at least should, in the modern era than in the thousands of years beforehand, where these great ideas around which people orient their lives, their communities, their identity, democracy, capitalism, freedom of expression, whatever those ideas are, they may or may not be kosher and appropriate ideas, but they certainly are lofty, certainly are inspiring, and man wants to lead life based on inspiration, not based on fear and suppression. And it's one thing if you don't live in that world of ideology and idealism, but it's another thing if you spend your most noblest moments living for ideals and self-sacrificing, and then religion is basically just living in a cage out of fear of reprisal and fear. So it would create that offset which would cheapen, and it's always that offset that's dangerous. You can choose to lead whatever religious life you have. This is me speaking now. Choose to lead whatever religious life you want, but just make it authentic. So the classic Musar talks about the world being full of goblins and darkness, and it's that world that's terrible, and it's, you should ignore it. I don't find that message necessarily inspiring. That's why I don't read that type of Musar. But a lot of people do, which is fine if that's the world you live in. But to read a Musar book and to try to convince yourself of that world and then go outside, pick up your cell phone, go into a luxury van, go watch the Dodgers game, go to a restaurant, you're engaged in the world. You don't see the world that way. So it creates artificiality, compartmentalization, bifurcation, schizophrenia, hypocrisy, and then religious practice without religious ethic. That's that whole dangerous slide from lack of integration. I keep telling you girls, it's the integration of religion. You're the same from person wherever you are. You can, that's what you should be shooting for. It's not going to happen for a long time, but that's what you'd be shooting for. So one day you could say, I could be in shul, I could be with Rabbanim, and I could be with my grandchildren, and I can be with shul. I'm the same person, same values. I may dress differently. I may be eating a hot dog at a picnic, or reading a sefer with a chavruta, but it's the same me, and it's the same person. It's hard. When you're young, there are different parts of you. Just think about who you are in different contexts. But you want to bring it together, and then it's all Avodas Hashem, and it's all the same continuity. So to have the same thing with women's education. You could argue ideologically whether women should be exposed to Talmud Torah. The reality is that women are advancing, in my opinion, Baruch Hashem, socially, economically, educationally. So that offset would be a killer. All of a sudden, for women to be advanced in every single aspect of their lives and then be, to use retarded in a pejorative sense, but be retarded and delayed and suppressed in their interaction with Torah, would create such an offset that I think it would tear a hole through the religious fabric of our societies and our families. And it's just something that isn't a women's issue. It's a people's issue. It's a family issue. Family bliss, as you'll see, marital bliss is such a delicate dance of two people and their needs and their parity and their. I sometimes laugh when people call it women's issues. These are women's issues. I've got four daughters and I have a wife, and Baruch Hashem, and every single one of these aspects will trigger. And I don't live in my teepee. My wife lives in her teepee. Okay, this is your issue. Whatever is her issue will be my issue. Okay, it's an issue about women, but it affects my life because her emotional state is my emotional state. And I chuckle to myself and go, now, it could be that men are less capable of articulating responses because I can't feel it as deeply as you can. Sometimes women ask me questions. I just can't feel it. I've never been a woman, so I can't place myself into your shoes. As much as I can try to identify and sympathize with the common human experience, I believe males and females are just very, very different. Baruch Hashem, very different experiences, and that's why you should have women try to respond to that question or to that issue. But it's more than just a suppressive aspect. This is very, I mean, every one of these statements of Rav Amital is just so characteristic and so signature. He said, after the Holocaust, Rav Amital, the Holocaust was a real difference maker on many, many fronts. He says, people were so heroic in the Holocaust, and they faced such dire consequences and such ghastly prospects that they had lived beyond fear. And to talk about a religion based on fear would just be lip speak, lip service. What does it mean to talk to someone? I mean, just to tell you a joke, because I had twice contact with Natan Sharansky this week. He gave the book launch last week. I told you about the book launch Thursday night, and then he was at a rabbi's panel. I was at. I have a friend who was in the army with Natan Sharansky when he was released from Russia. So he came and did his army service for a couple of weeks at a very advanced age. It was called Schlafbett, where he had all these old fogies who made Aliyah when they were 28 and 30. Put him in the army for a few weeks, show the movies about Tzav Hagana Yisrael, the Palmach, show him how to shoot a pistol, let him run around a little bit, teach him discipline, just in case they're needed in a war, so they can go out and maybe be the rear guard, be the home front, whatever. I was actually drafted to that funny unit, but then I got sick and they sent me home. Not because the routine was too tough. I got, you know, CMV and other viruses, so forget it, we don't want you. It shows how much they wanted me to begin with. Anyway, so this friend of mine was saying that the joke in the unit was, what happens if Natan Sharansky disobeys his commander? So the commander's job is to impose disciplines. He'll say, Sharansky, one day of solitary confinement for you. Whoa! I'm scared now. One day. Like it was impossible to discipline. I've already been through it all. So that time, I spent 9 years in solitary confinement. You're not scaring me. I eat that for breakfast. Same type of thing here. Rav Amital said, talk about a religion based on fear of repercussions. The people had outlived the Holocaust and Hitler. It's just, that's not who they were. They showed superhuman. It's such a mind-boggling concept for Rav Amital to say, and so much of Rav Amital's thought was to try to recreate religious identity after the Holocaust. More so, and he quoted Rav Kook, and we're running a little bit late, so I'll just paraphrase. And to me, this is the most, of all the three issues, this is the most penetrating, is fear is an emotion which by definition is contraction. It contracts the human spirit, it creates conservatism, it creates precaution, timidity, temerity, concern. That's going to express itself in other areas. So much of religion is drive and commitment and expansion and ascending and transcending your limits. So you're introducing an emotion that's contradictory to so many vital emotions necessary for religion. I never heard that. To be honest, I don't know anyone that could ever say that other than Rav Amital, inspired by Rav Kook. It takes Rav Kook to say that. To understand the human psyche so well, and to say that by harping upon fear, you're essentially shrinking human imagination, and human initiative, and human boldness. I just feel like you have to read a little bit of Rav Kook, because it's so brilliant. It's probably the second one in his Midos HaYira. It's actually, he's missing his Yira Kuv Gimel. HaMusag, it's on the back part of the second page. HaMusag Shel Yiras Hashem. It's supposed to, in its ideal form, Mosif Os V'Gavuras HaNefesh Shalita in her strength. V'Adam HaMeivin Osa B'Tar Asa. You should make your life full of content and ambition. It should fill you, I'm just translating loosely, with exalted spirituality, the second line, which purifies your talent with a holy light. Line number three, Amnam Lifamim, sometimes he mit yatseves kisemel shel behala, causes panic. Hagorem is rifion, weakness, yeosh, despair, chesron oni, and ineptitude. Zos hashpa hi ramao, this is very, very dangerous. Uchashe titpashe, when it spreads, he goremis his skomemus al klal ol malchus shemayim, causes a rejection of malchus shemayim. This is very deep. It's not just post-Holocaust people aren't afraid anymore. In the modern era, people are idealists. But you're introducing, fundamentally, existentially, a suppressive rather than a catalyst, rather than an enabler. So Rav Amital didn't believe that that should be the central pivot of Yerushalayim. So then Rav Amital moved to the second form of Yerushalayim, which one could claim the Slobodka Yeshiva excelled at. the beauty of Hashem, the awe of our creation, standing in awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's distance and unknowability, the godless Hashem and the Katnus Adam, the sweep and majesty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And of course, there's no shortage of sources describing that Yerush Shemayim, starting with the Mesillas Yesharim. Even Mesillas Yesharim, this is now on the back of page 2, backside of page 2, says, Hamina Beis, Hu Yerush HaRamimus, Shadam Yerchak Min HaChatoyim. Why? Eich Yekal, line number 2. You want to eat that food? You want to commit that sin? Forget the fire. Forget the boiling excrement. Forget the hellfire. Forget the pins and needles in your eyes. Toothpicks under your fingernails. Mice down your back, down the back of your shirt. Forget that. You're such an abba. This was classic Slobodka. In classic Musar, which is pre-Slobodka, the original Musar, if I'm speaking in a male world, if a male sees an attractive woman walking down the street, how do you avoid that temptation? Two words. Rima vitaleya. Dust and worms. She may look attractive, but it's all fleeting and transient. Just imagine in 80 years what that attraction will look like. In Slobodka? Ooh. That woman is beautiful. But Pasnish, you're a prince. And you serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't degrade the world. Upgrade your own calling to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, godless Adam. Pasnished. You can pursue the elusive, unattainable Hashem, and you're going to waste it on something beautiful and entertaining, but it's still just this world. Eich yerav libo shel basar v'adam. How could you commit your heart? Line number 2. You're shafal v'nimas. You're so low. Lasos dava neged v'tzona shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu yizbarach v'yisala. You can soar to the heavens, and you're going to shackle yourself to pleasures of this earth? As the Rambam writes, next source. Hechi aderach lirasa v'avasa, very famous Rambam, avasa v'irasa nechus yisod v'yatara. So the Rambam first talks about avas Hashem. We won't talk about the interplay between av and yira right now. You study the world, you study Torah, you see the beauty, the majesty, the infinity, the sweep. Line number 3, uch shemachashe b'devar ma'ilu atzman. When you realize this, don't look at me, girls. Miyad, who near to the acharav, you're flung back like some wind in a movie, like the Avengers, I don't know, some force field. Near to the acharav, you're not terrified, you're afraid. You're standing, let's say you see a humpback whale leaping in front of your boat. You're not afraid, you're in a boat. You're looking at an iceberg. You're standing on Mount Everest. Breathtaking. Like, you're not afraid. It's beyond words. Look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When's the last time you realized that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is beyond words and you just had that breathtaking moment? So, and I'm going to contaminate and compromise and forfeit all that, my silly little chay. Yeah, of course. When's the last time you had onion rings? You know what it's going to do to your breath, right? You know it's going to take you a day to get your breath back, but you just want to, for onion rings. I'm going to compromise this fantastic breath of mine, not mine, but your fantastic breath. Take your breath away. And that's, of course, the second wave of Musa. That was Slobodka. That's what I like. I love to read that Musa. Godless Adam. Hashem gifted. You know, the world isn't dark and goblin infested. Man is great. Man, even though he fell from grace, he's still great. And change your world. Empowerment. For Rav Amital, even that was insufficient. Why? Very fascinating. Because in 1960 and 1970, that's so fascinating, was different than 1870 or 1920. Because in 1920, man was still enchanted by the discovery of his world. So enchantment with the other could be rewoven into the religious fabric to be enchanted with Hashem. All of a sudden it's 1960 and you're living in a postmodern world of disillusionment. I mean, I imagine for many of you, you don't even know what I'm talking about. What does it mean to be enchanted? I'm not enchanted. I go to the burger's bar and I get a hamburger and I take my cell phone and I'm on social media and I take a selfie and I Google everything I need to know. And there's no discovery, and there's no mystery, and there's no enchantment, there's no...
reminds me of the time I was in Buckingham Palace. I was your age, a little older, and we were three yeshiva bach, and we went there during Ben Hazmanim after Tisha B'Av, bristling with our desire to discover Hashem. And we went in Buckingham Palace, and these beautiful, beautiful tapestries depicting biblical images that covered these long palatial catering hall size. I mean, tapestries that were 500 feet long and 400 feet high. Can you imagine? It took teams of 30 women 40 years to sew. And we were just fresh off of Rav Aaron Shiur. David and Goliath, Isaac and Abraham. Magadlu Masecha Hashem, Magadlu. And we're walking in front of this tour group of a couple elderly women from Houston. We're walking to one of these next rooms, I was eavesdropping on these women, and one of them said, "Hey, Agnes, look, more curtains." I said, "Oh, no, it's not curtains. Curtains you get for $19.99 in Kmart." Beautiful works of art. This is a God's spirit pulsating through the hands of, look, more curtains. Help myself in. Thank God. I would have been in prison in Buckingham Palace. And those prisons are very dangerous. The old horrific prisons of London, London Palace. So I was very quiet. Rami Tal correctly said, we don't really live in an enchanted world. The world has become very drab, very olive-colored, very dreary, very predictable, very despair. I mean, this is your world. And so you need some inspiration. You need a world that returns to the world of discovery and the world of enchantment and the world of withholding and disclosing. And again, to a degree, again, I'm the last person in the world that should be speaking to you about this, but when it does come up, think a lot about tznius. I mean, the primary thrust of tznius has nothing to do with men and women and sexuality. It has to do with seeing yourself as standing in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's what tznius is. Don't let it. The core of tznius is you and a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And when you're standing in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, I have a chiv of tznius, you have a chiv of tznius. My chiv of tznius demands that I talk in a certain way and behave in a certain way and project myself in a certain way. And it's less to do with my body, because Hashem didn't create the male body in the same way as the female body. For a female, tznius, one aspect is body image. But tznius is not about men who are going to see us. I mean, that may have to be taken, they may not. I'm not in any way. That's not the core. That's why the only time in halacha there's no din of tznius is when you're dancing in front of a sefer Torah. So David HaMelech danced so wildly and violently and uncontrollably, and Michal, his wife, couldn't understand it. And the point is, because the whole purpose of tznius is to recognize Hashem's presence. When recognizing Hashem's presence means lack of restraint, then you don't have to have tznius. So ask yourself if, I don't know, next time you want to question your tznius, whether it expresses itself in dress or anything else, what would you do if so-and-so were in the room? Because it's hard to imagine Hashem in the room, so someone that you really respect and really look up to, would you say that, act that way of that person? And again, that can't be the constant lid on your behavior, because it's still different, but some controlling feature that you know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in your space and in your proximity and you act accordingly. But part of tznius, at least in the male-female encounter, is there's so much of enchantment, and males and females are meant to be enchanted with each other, and males are meant to be enchanted with females in some ways different than the ways females are meant to be enchanted with males. I'm not a marriage counselor, but you can speak to marriage counselors with famous APC. Just a little bit of free advice. If you're in a relationship with a male, don't be the chaser. It's the role of the male to be the chaser. If there's a relationship that you always have to be the chaser and let's get it started, that's not the way it's supposed to be. The male is supposed to, again, not running after you, in the car first thing. You're supposed to be trying to make it. That's built into the male-female relationship. And it's supposed to be mystery and enchantment and discovery and understanding it, not just physical, emotional, and spiritual. It's supposed to be an entire process. And tznius helps that process along. And lack of tznius blunts and thwarts that process. So that's part of the natural male-female interaction that absence of tznius sometimes can hinder. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about. It's just a generalization. Anyway, but getting back to Rav Amital's, we don't really live in a time of enchantments. Just to finish and to conclude, Rav Amital felt that in the modern era, Yerushalayim has to be rerooted, not as fear of reprisal and repercussion, not even as enchantment and with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's majesty. Let's get some more water next time. But what he felt is commitment, and that's why his book, his one, his final writing, the Commitment and what's that in English called? Commitment and Complexity or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I have this fond memory of him actually standing by the photocopy machine in Yeshiva, taking his handwritten text. He thought a lot about this, talked a lot about it. I think he even once asked me to read it. Like, that would be a lot on his mind, because in the modern Hebrew milieu, a lot of Israelis will say, "Ani lo mitchaberet, ani lo mitchaber, ze lo medaber elai, lo medaberet elai, lo mitchaber." Doesn't Reinfeld felt that was a very dangerous, phraseology for religion. At some point, religion has to be commitment, not connection, not chaber. Covenant, responsibility, duty. Again, there was an overlap between Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital. Their language was different. Their background was different. A sense of living duty and living commitment and living covenant and living responsibility, of course, impassioned and animated and energized by passion, connection, drive, interaction, but still steered by responsibility and duty. So for Rav Amital, he felt that commitment, and interestingly enough, he felt that we should relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our commitment to a degree the way we relate to our parents and our commitment to our parents. He felt that could be a template for learning and studying commitment. And he quoted a Gemara that green lights, that validates the employment of human relationships as a approximation of our relationship with Hashem. And that's what made Rav Amital. I always marvel at how astute he read texts and how imaginatively he interpreted them and extrapolated them for someone that never had even a high school education. It always just amazed me. How did he get that imaginative? I've studied texts. I've studied texts in formal settings. And it just, I've rarely seen someone that can read a text and apply it creatively to a different context which wasn't its original intention. So, and this is a classic example. Not in a way which corrupts it, but just in a way that snatches a deeper layer of meaning. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was sick, this is the second to last source, his Talmidim came to visit him. And he's crying. And they say, "Rabbeinu, Baruchinu, give us a bracha." So what's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's bracha? He wrote down, "Shtei mara shamayim aleichem ki mara basar vadam." Well, fear Hashem like you fear man. Amulot tamid avad kan. Shouldn't we fear Hashem more than we fear man? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, "Halavai." Halavai, you should fear HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way you feel man. Right? What types of things do people commit in private that they wouldn't commit in public, but they're not afraid of Hashem? And now, the primary voice of this Gemara is Yirat Shamayim, deathbed scenes. For Rav Amital, the image that emerged was the ability to use fear of man as a baseline for our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That even though they're two very, very different experiences and interactions, being that our fear of human beings or our relationships in general with human beings is very concrete and graphic and palpable, so that may make our Avodas Hashem similarly compelling and vivid, even though there's a discrepancy between the way we relate to Hashem and people, but still, for the sake of vivid, anchored experience, we can employ human experiences despite the offset, despite the asymmetry. And Rav Amital felt that Kibbutz Av Va'Em could service that role. And he quoted a Gemara Kiddush. And again, everything was of the Gemara or Medrash, that Rav Amital was an innovator, was a revolutionary, but everything was very traditionalist. So he talked about the Gemara Kiddush, Kabeid Es Avicha, the final source, V'Yasimecha. And the same phraseology is employed in Mishlei to describe your covet for Hashem. Kaved es Hashem mehoncha. Hish v'hakasav kibud avraim l'kavod hamakom. There's a parallelism between kibud avraim and kavod Hashem. It's Hashem mokech atira, ishim ovav atira, not just for kavod, but for mara. Let me just read. I think it's out of the book Commitment and Complexity. But let me just read something that Amital again wrote in English, in Hebrew, but that was the one of the Alei Tzion. It's freedom from responsibility is not unique to our society. It exists in other places as well, particularly in Western countries. However, in our compact society, Israel, replete as it is with political, religious, ethnic, and social tensions, its effect, freedom from responsibility's effect, is destructive in the extreme. The placement of liberal individualism as the center pillar of our culture. Girls, go back to college next year. This is it in a nutshell. American culture, college campuses, liberal individualism. These are two separate statements, two separate modalities and thought spaces, but they overlap. Liberalism and individualism. Liberal individualism as a central pillar of our culture, coupled with the ranking of the rights of the individual at the top of our scale of values, has led to the prevalent sense of freedom from commitment. The very notion of commitment to a cause or an object runs contrary to the concept of freedom. Therefore, any commitment, whether to the nation, the state, society, one's spouse and family, has no place in the era, sadly, of the individual. To my mind, this sense of freedom from commitment constitutes a significant factor in the decrease of motivation in the army. It's 1991, Baruch Hashem. We've seen a resurgence in people joining Korki units, but sadly enough, we've seen an uptick in divorce rates, dysfunctional families, extramarital affairs, and lack of commitment. You get married, you're committed. That's it. You choose commitment. And think of Haredi marriages, which by no means are less successful than our types of marriages. And they don't fall in love. They find someone they can fall in love with. And the expectations of love are based on family compatibility, partnership, raising children, commitment to common cause. So, again, sometimes that commitment again comes. Just because you fall in love doesn't mean you have healthier marriages. How quickly can you get to that point with this commitment? And in their society, the commitment comes from family and expectations in society. In our society, we'd like it to come from, on the one hand, a love and a bonding that you find between a male and a female, but of course some sense of a larger self-imposed commitment, responsibility, covenant. And definitely just, I remember a very funny conversation I had on a plane. Someone, a physics professor at MIT, who says, Rabbi, explain something to me. How can I ever marry my wife? Maybe our trajectories will overlap, but then she'll continue on her trajectory, and I'll continue my trajectory. And I was trying to explain to him, it's not about physics, and not about overlapping trajectories. You find someone, you build a life, and you're committed to each other, financially, emotionally, family, children, granny. You live a life with a partner, and it's not just because you find a flaw or imperfection or some insufficiency, it doesn't mean you acquit yourself in the commitment. Obviously, if it reaches the point where you can't dispense your commitments anymore to one another, just the emotional gap and the emotional chasm is so broad, then of course you divorce. But it's not, oh, I don't like this aspect of my spouse. I don't like him. That should enter your marriages. You'll see, you'll fall in love with someone. You'll think that person's perfect. Mitzvah, you'll discover, I mean, the first person to burst your bubble. You'll discover, as great as your chassan is, you'll discover he's not perfect. He'll discover you're not perfect. And the things hold to get on your nerves and irritate you and things you don't get on his nerves. And then you say, okay, but that's life. And every person in life has that irritability, and especially when you live with that person 24 hours a day. And you realize there's so much common between you and so much positive in that person, and you're so committed to your values. That's how you adjust your personality. So anyway, so this was Rav Amital's definition of Yir Shamayim. It's nice to think about. Not, God forbid, to the neglect or repudiation of the classic Yir Shamayim. How part of the Yir Shamayim will be driven by fear, and part of the Yir Shamayim will be driven by this enchantment. But he tried to introduce a leavening factor, like leaven, to make it rise. Otherwise, it will be flat. But I think part of that bread, part of the ingredients to keep the metaphor, is still the fear and still the enchantment. And this should make it even more. And I'm committed to Hashem, because we're at the stage in history where it's pretty clear that our commitment is starting to pay off, and this commitment to us has been something which has survived and surpassed all the typical laws of nature and nationhood. So we live in a period of post-Holocaust commitment. We're committed to you, you're committed to us. We're in the same, so to speak, the same boat. You can't get rid of us, we can't get rid of you. I'm just using colloquial terminology. We're in this together through thick and thin, through the ghastly, horrific moments of the Holocaust, to the triumphant moments of the Western Wall and the paratroopers. We're walking side by side. We better move points, lesser points. We're married to your Kodesh Baruch Hu, you're married to us. You know, let's make this work. Let's get to the conclusion. Let's get to Mashiach. It's a very, very realistic and honest, and hopefully the type of Yir Shamayim that helps people live reality rather than charades. So you have to be very, very careful when you're living religion as a charade. At some point, it may catch up with you. That's just because people live religious values that you don't feel are authentic. I mean, for them, it's a charade. If it's consistent, it's not a charade. But everyone has to check themselves. When you're just posturing, it's probably going to catch up with you at some point. At the very least, the desiccation of spirit. The spirit will dry up, and it'll just be practice and robotics and rhetorics. If it's deep and it's real and it clings to reality, it makes sense in the real world, then it's who you are. It's your identity. It's And I think Rav Amital really introduced that into a modern world that was fearful of abdicating perhaps some of the old-fangled approaches that had proven so powerful in Europe, but were clearly corroding, you know, eroding in the New World. And he's responsible for many people in our world. Just simple things that you don't even realize, the fact that I'm sitting here, I don't know, in a striped shirt, that somehow, and not a suit or a jacket or a tie or a hat or a long black frock, or it makes me feel more real because this is who I am. I'm not dressing up the part. And hopefully that makes my own experience and by extension my teaching more authentic. But also there's less of a distance between us. It's not like I'm sitting in your own, on the lifeguard station and I'm talking down through a loudspeaker. I could be your father. I could be, you know, but the gap is lessened. It feels... Your grandparents didn't have these types of classes. Your parents probably didn't have these types of classes. I'm not saying my class. I'm all your teachers as well. It becomes so prevalent. It's not just a Ramitel, but a more of a low-key, scaled-down, realistic, less, I don't say pompous, because that's a pejorative, but less formalized, less posturing, and what's the role of the... Like I was, again, I don't want to record this for people who aren't here and will get the wrong impression, but I was just, and there's nothing.